Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Gender Studies. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Lindy McDougall of Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, to talk about her new book, The Perfect Vagina, Cosmetic Surgery in the 21st Century, out this year, 2021, with Indiana University Press. Hello, Lindy, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Yana. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's lovely. How are you this your evening in Australia?
Yes, they're good. Yeah, it's dark and cool, but cold is not really what we get here. We think it's cold and it's sort of less than 20 degrees. it's very pleasant. Thank you.
Wonderful. Yeah, at 20 is in the Netherlands, when we hit 20, people start complaining about the heat. So
yes, that's right. Yeah. Well, think of what's happening in Canada at the moment.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah, the same back home in the States. It's just miserable. I hate global warming. I know that's a bold move, bold statement there, but just
we need
let
to
me say
conversation
it.
About that.
Yeah, it's true. All right. So I was so happy to see this book come up when I was like, you know, as I trolling the publishers, as I do, to see who I might like to talk to. It's such a great topic. I had a student a couple years ago who would have been thrilled to find this book because this is really some unique and groundbreaking work you're doing. I mean, that's a really good sign. It's very new and exciting. There's so much to unpack here, but before we go any further, I'd like you just explain to our listeners what exactly we're talking about when we talk about female genital alteration. What procedures might this encompass?
Okay, so if we're talking about female genital alterations or cosmetic surgery in the West, and it's carried out not just in the West, but particularly in the States, Europe, Australia, but also in Asian countries increasingly, and even in Africa. So basically, these are alterations that are done for cosmetic purposes, and they include, and they vary from country to country, but in Australia, labiaplasty is the most common, and that is decreasing the size of the labia minora, the inner lips of the vulva, and there's also G-spot amplification, labia majora reduction, liposuction of the mons pubis, vaginal tightening, also things like vulval bleaching. So it's a whole array of things. In Australia, in my research, focused on labiaplasty because that's the most common female genital cosmetic surgery occurring in Australia. I have done some research in the United States as well, mostly with the medical profession, and they're things like vaginal tightening to narrow the vagina so there's more sexual satisfaction, for whom I'm not sure. So that is actually more common. It's not actually particularly common in Australia. So my research was basically focused in Australia on labiaplasty. Also, clitoral dehooding is another thing that is done, which is to remove some folds around the clitoris. Sometimes this is for aesthetic reasons, to make the clitoris look less protruding if you've pared away the labia minora. And sometimes it's thought that it might increase responsiveness in women. Of course, as you will know, having read my book, is that I don't think you can speak about female genital cosmetic surgery as a Western practice without referring to female circumcision. Sorry, I've got a list. And female genital cutting, as I call it, in other countries. So that all these procedures are procedures that are done to women either for aesthetic reasons or cultural reasons, and really to make so that women feel that they fit in to their society.
Yeah, I mean, if with that as a definition, you know, this cultural alteration done for cultural and aesthetic reasons to make women feel that they fit in, then there is not a distance between a labiaplasty and female genital cutting.
No, there's very big differences in age, consent, the medical situation, etc. But I suppose my curiosity came, well, we'll go into that maybe, but is that I think I sort of realised, well, you know, we can't sit here and say we don't do cultural things, that medicine isn't cultural. That's what I, that was my driving force, I think.
Yeah. And we do things to women's bodies. Women do things to their own bodies for cultural reasons.
For a certain reason, because they are persuaded that that's, for some reason or other, a good thing to do. And that happens in all cultures.
Right, absolutely. And I think that's really important to just, you know, to help us contextualize one of these ideas, because I think it's there are a lot of people who are going to be like, well, labiaplasty, women choose that. But female genital cutting, it's like, well, women choose that too. Just some of it.
They're completely polarized in the way that we look at them in the West. Yeah,
our discussion has them polarized. And I think it's good to put it on a spectrum and to consider that together. I think that's really important. There will be some complaints. We will hear about this conversation. I will hear about this conversation.
Yes, they're opposed.
Yeah, and I'm sure you have heard about this as well. Anytime you've said this publicly. Yeah.
I just think, all academic inquiry, I think you have to be game to go there.
Yeah. I mean, that's our job, right, is to ask questions.
Ask questions and see what,
See what happens. I mean,
the conclusion of my book is that, I don't know that it's really different to have female genital cosmetic surgery than having a nose job or something else. I'm not making that decision. All I'm saying is that it does bring into juxtaposition how we look at one culture against how we look at another culture.
Sure. And, you know, and also like what, how there's also people that are like, oh, good Lord, labiaplasty, but are totally fine with rhinoplasty. And on some level, we've just had rhinoplasty. We've talked about rhinoplasty for longer. But there's also, like, let's put this on a spectrum. Let's try to contextualize what we're talking about, right?
I think something to do with the sort of, I can't think of the word now, but the sort of controversial factor about cosmetic surgery. I mean, obviously the doctors who perform these surgeries don't think it's controversial at all, and then the media hype it up at times. But the thing is that actually I think the fact that it's so linked to sexuality in a way that breast surgery, although probably it should be, is not, is there's something about altering the genitalia that has more people more concerned or people more opinionated about it.
Yeah, more opinionated.
Job or something, or,
certainly more opinionated. So you open your book with an excerpt from an interview you held with a woman named Mandy, or perhaps not named Mandy, whatever, but Mandy, who wants a labiaplasty. And so can you tell us what she had to say? Can you just kind of run down what her concerns are?
Well, Mandy was interesting. She came from a medical family. And she was obviously very, I would say, sort of an anxious woman. And initially she was concerned about her protruding labia and was keen to have labiaplasty. But then as the conversation went on, I spoke to her several times. She then also was concerned about having vaginal tightening because she'd had, when I first spoke to her, she was pregnant, then afterwards she'd had a baby. And I suppose, so she was worried about aesthetics and function. But actually, I don't know if I'm not a psychologist or, but I think in lots of ways she was concerned about her relationship and trying to be attractive to her partner. And in some ways she was nervous about her, well, concerned about how she looked and
and how she looks, but also
not overly confident.
No, right. She seems to care about how she looks, but she's also worried that, like, that her body has changed in this way as a result of
childbearing and
right.
Yeah. That but she was pregnant with a third.
Yeah, child. And three kids is a lot. Yeah. And you know, the childbirth does some violence to your body.
Yeah.
But you know, yeah, she seemed to be worried about being attractive, like visually, but attractive as in her ability to keep her husband happy as well, to maintain a sexual health.
Yeah, she wanted to have, as she said, I want to get into bed, and she didn't want getting into bed to be a boring thing where he didn't find her attractive or whatever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, that indicates some sort of insecurity. And where does that come from? Where is that generated?
Let's talk about that. Like, why, you know, where does that come from? How did Mandy and the women like Mandy convince you to write this book?
Well, I guess when I set out, I had no idea what I was going to find out. Mm-hmm. I just became interested in the subject. And so... And I had lots of intimate conversations with women, which really sometimes put me in a bit of a difficult situation. But I suppose what came up is that a lot of women are quite insecure about how their vulvas look, and they want to be, I can't think of a better word than say, to be loved and accepted, and that they feel, and I think this is generated, we can unpack it a bit further down the line, but I think they see in the media and articles and social media, they see other women's bodies. I'm not a fan of saying that pornography is a huge driver for this. I think it has a big factor to play. But things like, as Mandy discusses, I'm not sure it's in that opening part, but it's certainly later in the book, about pubic grooming and how, you know, a lot of women feel insecure about having a Brazilian or something because their labia minora fall down beyond their labia majora. So I think this whole thing is that they see images. And there's a lot of the other thing which I think in the perfection chapter go on to is this idea that you should care for yourself, that it's a woman's responsibility, not just a woman, obviously men as well, but in our neoliberal society is this: you need to work on the body, make sure you're presentable, and to be acceptable and happy, you need to do the best you can do. And that used to be, maybe it used to be washing your hair or whatever it happens to be, but now it's extended to your genitalia.
Yeah, now we have other medical interventions, right? Yes, it's not just about dieting.
Yes, not just. So it's more, that's a bit, where can we go from here, really?
Yeah, I mean, then we're into Hunger Games territory, maybe.
Yeah.
And I also want to mention, this is an interview which makes up the basis of your source material for this book, right? You interviewed several women.
I interviewed 22 women. I put a questionnaire on the web, and probably had about, I don't know, 40 or 50 responses, 40 something, I think. And of that, 22 women agreed to be interviewed. So I interviewed them, some of them several times. And so they form my main source material and the characters in the book. And so that was the core of my research with women. Then I interviewed about 40 doctors. I don't know. We have a different categorization between plastic and cosmetic surgeons in Australia. Plastic surgeons are much better trained in plastic surgery. Cosmetic surgeons are just GPs who call themselves cosmetic surgeons because that's what they're interested in. Gynecologists, yeah. Whereas in America, the number of people doing these operations is much broader. There's also dermatologists and other people doing them. But, yeah, so I interviewed mostly plastic cosmetic surgeons and a few gynecologists, and got their perspective. And the other thing I did in my research was go to conferences and things where medical conferences and women's health conferences where the issue of female genital cosmetic surgery was either the main focus of the conference or an issue that was brought up at a conference in the case of women's health.
Right on. All right.
So sort of like and I did most of my research in Australia except for, and I did a lot of searching, obviously, on the web and everything, so to find what was happening in other areas of the world. And then I did go to a conference in Las Vegas on cosmetic gynecology, which forms one of my checklists.
Yeah, wow. That, I'm guessing, was quite a cultural experience.
Yes, it was pretty amazing. It was pretty, I think I say in the book, is quite daunting as a woman to be sitting in a room of sort of 100 or so, mostly men. Only three women spoke at the conference, and one of them was my colleague, a psychologist from Australia, talking about how women needed to sort out their bits.
Yeah, that's
money.
Yeah, that's about.
And that's a very cynical sort of attitude, but that's what I found out. And yeah.
No, it seems like a very reasonable way to look at this. All right, so back to kind of the story here. I want to read a brief passage. Mandy and I chatted about what is normal for vulval morphology. Normal isn't the right word, she said emphatically. There is no normal. The word I would like to use is aesthetically pleasing. After I watched The Perfect Vagina, listeners, that's an English documentary from 2007. All right. After I watched The Perfect Vagina and saw the plaster casts of a wide variety of vulvas, that certainly changed my opinion a lot. The majority of women are so different to the ideal, and everyone's in the same boat. We're all different to the ideal, so what is normal? Unquote. And I love that she's aware of this. Like, Maddie doesn't think there's a normal vulva, but she has an idea of what makes an attractive vulva. And that kind of, that throws me in a bit of a spin. Like, help me understand how you can say there's no normal, but still consider surgery to make yourself more attractive, according to a standard that she has to know that is plastic and constructed.
I think that what I found out was that there is no normal vulva. There's no medical definition of what's a normal vulva. The measurements vary widely. But what women desire and what they consider normal is conflated with the ideal. So they think of what's an ideal, and then the ideal and the normal butt up against each other. And so the normal is actually what's statistically normal or what's medically normal is a wide range. But what women consider normal, or even maybe doctors consider normal, is what's really more the ideal, which is what is shown in the media and in text and even in stylized medical drawings of vulva. So although I don't think most women realize that there's great variety, and doctors admit that as well, but that's not what women want or doctors feel that they can provide.
Right, sure. So Mandy then is fairly normal in this regard. She's representative of the women who seek plastic or cosmetic surgery.
Yeah, and that's how she rationalizes it. I mean, she's not she's an intelligent woman. But, I mean, I guess we all, in lots of ways, I mean, we all do things to make ourselves not statistically normal, I suppose. I mean,
sure. And we all do things to be our best, what we conceive to consider to be our best.
It comes back to that working on self idea, the Foucauldian sort of idea that we should work on ourselves and transform ourselves into what fits into society.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Sure. I just did an interview with a guy named Jürgen Marczukat on a book called The Age of Fitness that talks about how much working on our bodies is a demonstration of like moral goodness. And, you know, and like this, there were a few times I thought back to that I kind of thought about that one. A great book, by the way, highly recommend.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's this other kind of question, you know, is why? And as you note, and this is a direct quote, there's no one answer to why female genital cosmetic surgery is increasing in popularity in the West. And so what you give us instead is a rhizomatic, non to Deleuze and Guattari, explanation, which is to say it's really hard to economically answer the question I'm about to ask you, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Why are women doing this?
Well, I think I did fall back on that rhizomatic thing. I couldn't put my finger on it. But I found that probably what was interesting in my research is that there's many multifactorial issues, and I think we all know that that's in everything in our lives. So basically, I do think that there could be people who are more susceptible to worrying about what their vulvas look like. I mean, other people will just say, well, you know, no one sees it much, I don't care, sort of thing. So I think there are lots of reasons, but I suppose one of the things that I wanted to highlight, I suppose from my perspective as a medical anthropologist, is that I think medicine has quite a big influence on the choices women make about their bodies, because medicine is considered to be acultural rather than being firmly embedded in culture. And also, you know, it's medicine is science, and therefore if a doctor says you can do this and it's just chop, chop, chop and that's that, fine. So whereas I don't think that women take into the fact that a lot of where women get their ideas of what is the sort of vulva that they want is not just pornography and magazines and things. It's also before and after images on doctors' websites. So you look like, so basically this is the before and this is the after, and then you end up with this.
So right.
The clean slip, which is sort of the ideal. And I think that persuades women that is what they can aspire to. So I think that, obviously, I think I say something in the book, but if there were no doctors who did it, well, the ideal wouldn't be there. I mean, it had to be how you were born.
Yeah.
That'd be it.
From most of human history, we haven't done it, right?
No.
And for different reasons. Yeah, that's absolutely, that was a completely wrong thing to say, Anna. Some level, the answer is because we can, right? We're always trying to improve, and this is the newest technology.
About, commercialization. I mean, I think that most of the doctors that I interviewed in Australia and all the doctors in America at the conferencings, they blatantly said they were in it for money.
Fair, okay.
Yes. And all the doctors have said, well, what's the as I mentioned earlier, I think, what's the difference between, you know, cutting off a labia and straightening a nose?
Sure. Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I think if we're like, well, one of these things is part of our sacred body or something, that's problematic in itself, right? The idea that there's some part of a woman's body that should not be touched is interesting.
There's a lot of historical unpacking you can do in that respect as well. sort of all the
sure.
history and
So
it's been movement from vulvas sort of maybe in the past being sort of sacred to now being malleable.
Yeah, and commercialized and and there's definitely I mean, but I think I want to make sure that our audience understands that this isn't just about pornography or media representation, that there's also a dialectic with the medical community as well. That was another one, you know, one of those moments where I was reading along in this book and I'm like, hey, wait, I've never thought that before. That's a great point. Like, yeah. And so then I think I'm now in this kind of circle of thinking about all of the medical procedures that we accept and impart just because someone tells us it's available so that a doctor can make money with it, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, it's a very sort of cynical thing, but that's what I found. The other thing is, of course, I think that, you know, sexualization in society is a big thing now, particularly in the younger cohort of women that I spoke to, the fact that they wanted to wear skimpy bikinis and, you know, and that as one of the doctors sort of said, and there's no room for labia in that, you know, like.
that is the truth.
Yeah. So women don't just want to, especially young women, they don't just want to feel aesthetically normal, which of course the normal, as we discussed, is not normal, it's ideal. But they also want to do what women of their age or any woman want to do. I mean, they want to be able to wear a bikini, they want to be able to go to the gym, and they want to be able to look good in different fashions, etc. So normal is not just about their vulvas per se, it's about everything else that goes on in their life that's attached to how they feel. That affects what they can do.
Yeah, so beyond, as you said, beyond the clean slit, compromising a smooth, you know, exterior, no flesh. And I think it's interesting if we contextualize, though, this, we have this image of women's bodies I want to spend a little minute on. And I'm going to quote you again. So we have a woman, quote, with markers of her secondary sexual status, breast, buttocks, and curves heightened and exaggerated with the exclusion of body hair, but with primary sexual markers, the vulva and vagina, reduced to absence. And I want to make sure, like, we're clear that this can't be found in nature. Hairlessness is not the hallmark of an adult woman, right? Like, that. So something, you know, just this is enough. But what's going on with this hypersexualized, no sexualized kind of female body? That's a very interesting body.
Yeah, I think it's something that's generated in images, in the media, or even in pornography. So basically having big breasts and long hair and curvy hips and things is a mark of a woman. But I suppose my point is, then why are we taking away what really is the mark of a woman, which is her vulva? Why would... So what is going on? What is going on here? And one of the reasons, of course, is particularly in pornography, is that in Australia anyway, for pornography to appear sort of more in the mainstream, the censorship laws say that you can't have, I can't remember what the term is. They said it's like obvious. I've forgotten what the term is they say. But, you know, you can't. So basically they are digitally altered. They take and do what's called digital labiaplasty, which is in a production room before pornography and stuff goes to air or images go to air in magazines that you can buy over the counter, for instance, not R-rated things. They just use a digital device to remove the labia. And so because that's considered too... What's the word? It's in the book, actually. It's too confrontational.
We don't want you to be confronted by labia when you're looking at porn.
Yeah. So it's just, to be honest, that's the law in Australia anyway, pornography, for it to be available on the shelf or for over 18s. Of course, the thing is with pornography, with the internet, you can get onto all sorts of sites of pornography and see all sorts of things. But there has been some research to say that a lot of women prefer to see stylized sort of women with, you know, like the image that you just said that I suggested. But then some of the women that I interviewed also were happy to see homemade pornography with all different sorts of vulvas. Mm-hmm. So I think the thing, that's why I suppose I decided that I'm not absolutely convinced that pornography itself per se is a huge influence, because women are smart and they know things have been digitally altered, and there's a great lot of variation. But I think that comes back to an earlier point is, although everyone knows it's normal to have different looking vulvas, that's not what they want. They want the ideal.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You know, and there's a lot of work about kind of pornography and how sex has become a visual as much as it is tactile, and the perfect kind of, this is a sexualized body that's about viewing and not touching on some level. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, labiaplasty, if we're talking about vaginal tightening or something, then it's a different situation. One more point I really want to hit before I let you go is the tension between self-care and self-obsession, right? Like, there's this tight line for women to walk, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, specifically since women are always kind of precariously balanced on this line anyway, because you have to be attractive, but you don't want to be, you want to be attractive, you want to be productive, you want to be alluring but not overly sexual. It's impossible. Like, there's this line that's impossible. You know, so you've got, you know, and I think about like what I do to remain attractive, you know, what I consider attractive, and there's all this like good skincare and foundational garments and hair, but I don't want to be some high maintenance yoga lady who calls her narcissism self-care.
She needs to get a life.
Yeah. But yeah. So like, what is a woman to do? How do you manage this? And what
I found, I think you'll know, I found it varied. Like, there were some really down-to-earth women that I interviewed who, just like you and I, would probably think, you know, well, I could do a bit of work there that make me happier, and that's fine. Then in that chapter I write on perfection, there's obviously the women who are perfectionists, and they're not just perfectionists in how they look, but how they're vulvas are, or their pubic hair or whatever, they're perfectionists in their jobs. And the weirdest thing I found is that they think those two women, Kylie and Mia, who I talk about, not their real names, of course, who basically feel that if they do all this work on themselves, they're better people and they'll make other people happy. And so although it seems very self-obsessed, which you could argue that it could be, but it's they're on this project of what they feel is they're contributing more by working on themselves. And where does all this come from, which is the interesting point, isn't it? I mean, I think really, and you could say that they're being duped by what's possible and whatever. Or there's a good book by Tanner Meyer and Jeffries of what they call good vanity. And so in the old days, like, vanity was meant to be, you know, not a good thing. You know, you wouldn't want to say if someone was vain, it would be a detriment. Whereas now they say a certain amount of good vanity is expected. And I think that comes back to your point on the gym. Like, you know, you're meant to go to the gym, you're meant to do this and meant to do that. And the other thing that comes into this aspect as well is the, and I'm not a psychologist, so I mentioned it in the book, but I don't go into it in detail, is body dysmorphic disorder as something that drives women's desires to continuously work on their bodies. They don't see Kylie, one of the women in the book, she had three operations on her vulva and a breast augmentation in 1 year, within 12 months. I mean, it's being very driven, isn't it?
Yeah, that's interesting. It is. You see this, like, it's kind of this perfect storm on women's bodies, right? That, like, you know, the as capitalism tells us all that we constantly have to be working. You can't just not work.
Oh, and that goes for the whole economy. It has to grow all the time. Everything has to be going exponentially.
Yeah. And you personally must take part in that, or you're not being a good citizen.
That's right.
Yeah. And so then, you know, what is your body looking like? Are you doing your best to make yourself better, right? This like constantly striving to be this perfection that is unattainable and becomes ever more unattainable. I mean, like if we're digitally taking out people, like, you know, lengthening necks and changing the way that we have
people to make them look. Anyway, I won't go into, but I mean, you see, I've become really aware of it now. Like you look at it, you think, that person doesn't look like that.
Nobody looks like that.
But it does affect the opinions women make about their bodies. I mean, I think it's very complex because I think some women really do want to be what they consider normal. Like one girl that I interviewed was born with some sort of labial adhesion or something, so she had one labial which was much longer than the other. And I mean, you think, well, okay, it's like if you have my cousin had big ears and he had them pinned back. I mean,
yeah.
I fell off the horse and I had my nose done. So, so we all succumb to what we feel. I suppose my point is that we have to be cautious about being persuaded to go too far.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the point, right? Like, what's okay and where's the line where it's too far? And
who decides?
Yeah, who decides that? That's your very basic Foucauldian decision right there.
Our sort of commercial capitalist neoliberal society, it's the individual who decides.
But with restrictions, you know, like I actually just yesterday was talking to a friend who wants to get gender reassignment surgery, but she's getting top surgery. They had to go to several different doctors to get approval. Right. So there's also this place where you're not, where female bodies in particular, like bodies gendered female, are subject to oversight.
What worries me and comes back to, I suppose, my basic premise for the book or for my research is, but why has medicine got so much authority?
Yeah, that is a great question.
I just think that, you know, as an older woman, I know what I want to do with my body. So why should I, you know, why would that, usually a man, I talk in the book about the male gaze and the medical gaze, well, normally a man will tell me what I can and cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
And that
certainly
comes back to the whole debate about feminism, and we could go off for another 2 years.
Yeah, that's a whole that's another book. That's another hour of conversation. But I do find that very interesting how much we treat medical authority as if it were handed down, like it's the new religion, right? It's down from God. And
okay, we've got rid of God and now we've got medicine.
Yeah,
She's Dutch, isn't she?
Yeah.
She writes there that much about the authority of medicine, which I find very pertinent to my sort of argument. I think that we've just, it needs to be questioned.
And
the same with the case you were just talking about, you know, with your friend who wants to have surgery.
I mean, this isn't gender reassignment surgery. This is a way for this person to make a body that seems to suit them better, or her. She uses both pronouns. And that on some level, whose business is that, right? Because if you win and a breast reduction is incredibly common and super old and a medical necessity, and unless you seem to want it for other reasons, like, I find this all very interesting.
Yes.
I think
my research did what I hope I've sort of brought out the book is a bit about the authority of medicine to decide what women do with their bodies. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I think that's like if we look at, say, places like Africa, which is where I lived for many years, we think that's culture there asks women to do certain things with their bodies, and I suppose I'm saying, well, same things go on here, just in a different form. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just this other kind of point to put in the constellation of how we navigate, like, normal, attractive, and how we ought to be in the world, which is pretty complex. So are you continuing with this research? What are you thinking about?
No, pretty much not really. What I'm mostly doing at the moment is I'm mentoring PhD students at uni. I work part-time. I do really boring things like marking. And I'm writing another book, but it's not an academic book. Yeah.
Oh, tell me, what is it, if you don't mind?
It's more of a memoir type of thing.
Oh, wonderful. That's wonderful. I will look for it. All right, Lindy, thank you so much for taking time with me. It's a great conversation. I really love the book. Once again, The Perfect Vagina from Indiana University Press. Thanks much.
Oh, I just wanted to say before you go, I need to thank Indiana University Press very much. They've been so supportive. It's taken a long time, but they've been great to deal with. And the Australian Anthropological Society, who gave me a research grant to write the book. So I will
All right. Shout outs to both. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Cheers, Anna.